Good afternoon and welcome to the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water on this February 9th, 2012. Thanks for being here. Thank you, colleagues, for your attention. Listen closely, and I'll tell you how we're going to do things today. We are going to open a public hearing and possible work session on 4050 for the purposes of hearing the testimony of Co-Vice Chair Krieger, a person that I never make wait. But then we're going to go into recess so that we can hear 4112 and accommodate our colleagues who are other colleagues who are on the front row. So if you'll bear with us, I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4050. And Beth, if you'd give us the quick rundown while Representative Krieger takes his place.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4050 would eliminate the lottery system for ocean troll salmon fisheries. It removes provisions limiting transfers to certain vessels. It would not affect the validity of permits issued or renewed prior to the effective date of the act. There is a fiscal statement in your packet and no revenue impact.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep of District 1. Not too many. We've got one person from the coast here that really understands the fisheries, Representative Witz, Representative Bentz. I don't know for sure how familiar you are with some of the offshore fisheries, but a lot of our fisheries on the coast, salmon, crab, shrimp, nearshore live fish, for instance, are limited. You just don't go out and buy a license. In the case of salmon, that limited number of entry into that fishery and the number of boats in that fishery were 1,250 a few years back. We reduced that here in this body down to 1,000. And when they got down below a certain level, then the Department of Fish and Wildlife held a lottery where people can come in and put their name in the bag and try to pick up one of those salmon permits that hasn't been renewed. The fishermen, for the most part, I have not heard one opposed to the bill. The salmon troll commissioner in favor of the lobby person, Joe Rowletter, will address a few of the issues. But eliminating the lottery does a couple of things. It's going to drive up the value for the fishermen of their permits when they go to sell them. And that's part of selling the sky when you get old and you don't want to go out in that ocean anymore. Another part of the situation is that under the lottery system, when you got that, you were not limited for that permit to move from whatever boat had it, at a length that boat, into the next boat. It didn't require it to be within 5 feet. If you sell that permit, that is a requirement. This will make sure that we have a more balanced approach, that all those permits over time don't end up just on large boats that fish it a short time and then they're gone on to something else. I think it supports more of the diversity in the fleet as the size of the boats. Might just say before I leave is that this industry has had two disasters. Co-Chair Boone and I sat on the committee that allocated those federal disaster dollars to those boats in the past 6 years. It's happened twice. They're making application again. And so it's been a tough time in that fleet. Reducing those that are competing for that smaller number of fish, I think, would be better for the individual. They're going to be able to have a little more of a quota there per boat would be available. At the same time, we are also finding out that cormorants are taking 50% of our fish, seals a high percent, and that's just of the smolts before they get to the ocean. We met Monday with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Department of Fish and Wildlife. We're working towards getting management, which I think we will over time. If that happens, we'll be getting more fish to the ocean. That means we're going to get more fish back into the Columbia, and this competing for the pie won't be quite as vicious as it has been in recent years. So I hope you'll support this. This is what the fishermen feels best for them and the Commodity Commission that governs them. There's a lady who will talk to you about that. If you have any questions, I'm more than willing to answer it.
Any questions for our colleague before he departs?
Representative Benz, you were going to ask me a question.
I was, Representative, but I've forgotten the Latin phrase that you shared with me earlier.
And supposed to ask me if I knew what Onchiorhynchus chow was.
Odd that we forget that. But what is that?
It's Chinook salmon. I said, well, I didn't know anyone from Ontario would have a clue what that meant.
You're right.
How you queued him up, but it didn't work out.
Yeah, it didn't.
Well, thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
We will take further action on this shortly, but for now, I'm going to temporarily recess the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4050, and I'd like to open our first public hearing on House Bill 4112, and as our colleagues Representative Richardson and Representative Windard come forward, Beth, would you give us the overview?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4112 would require the Environmental Quality Commission to submit to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for approval revisions to the Oregon State Implementation Plan under the Federal Clean Air Act. The revisions to be modeled to the greatest extent practicable on the Washington model for inspecting motor vehicles for certification of pollution control systems.
Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Matt Wingard from House District 26, which is the communities of, and there's a reason for listing them this time, the communities of Wilsonville, Sherwood, Bull Mountain, and rural Washington County out to Gaston. A good portion of the folks that I represent, all the way even into Hillsboro, are in this DEQ area, and the vehicle inspection program that the bill we're about to talk about addresses. So I share most of my, or I should say many of my constituents' frustrations with the not only the time that's involved and the hassle factor of going through the DEQ vehicle inspection program, but a lot of folks who talk to me about this wonder whether or not it's still accomplishing its goals. It is a 40-year-old program, and so that's led me to ask some questions. And you may or may not know this, but the failure rate at the vehicle inspection stations is less than 7%, which means that 93% of the folks that are going to the trouble to drive over to the DEQ station and go through there are passing. And I read recently that Washington State has taken the step of beginning to try to phase out the vehicle inspection program that they run in their state. And I thought, let's not be the last state to do that. If Washington State can do it, then certainly we can. And further discussions have ensued, and I've had discussions with Associated Oregon Industries and with DEQ, and we have amendments to the bill. And the purpose of the amendments is to replace the bill and essentially ask DEQ to report back to us by the beginning, basically by February of next year, on what it would look like if we phased out the vehicle inspection. How would they do that if they did it? And plus, because it's part of an overall ozone containment program that we do in compliance with the EPA, what would the other levers be, essentially? If that program was not one of the ways that we met those goals, what would DEQ have to do in other areas in order to continue to meet the goals set by the EPA? And so we are very close. They've read the amendment. I think we're still negotiating just some words within the amendment, but I'm hopeful that very soon we'll have an amendment that you will hear AOI and DEQ and those of us who are on the bill all enthusiastically asking you to support. And with that, I'll turn it over to the representative.
Before you turn it over, just to be sure, it's only words that keep us from a compromise with DEQ, is that right?
In this case.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
Good. Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Richardson, a state representative for Southern Oregon between Medford and Grants Pass. The Medford air quality area is part of my district, and 40 years ago, this was a very important issue in Southern Oregon. We had smudge potch for the pear orchards. We had cars that were high polluters. We had areas, we had issues with the air quality that do not exist today, and yet this program continues to be enforced, and it's got momentum. The cars back then were not very clean, and now the technology has risen to a point where the cars are much, much cleaner, and the air quality is not an issue in Southern Oregon like it was before. I met with a constituent not long ago who owns a Jiffy Lube in Medford and Jiffy Lubes in Utah. In Utah, in the Salt Lake area, they also have inspections that take place, but his Jiffy Lube is one of those that does this as a service to their customers because it attracts customers. And so they just make a deal with the DMV in Utah, and they have stickers for license plates and they also have the certifications for clean emissions for the motor vehicles, and they take care of it with really no cost to the state and no additional cost to their customers. It's just an additional service that they provide. And so with the change in technology, the change in circumstances in agriculture, the change in the needs for air purity based on so many other factors, it would be a good time for us to consider phasing out a program that had its day four decades ago but no longer is necessary.
Thank you. Thank you both. How about questions for our colleagues? Seeing none, we thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next on our list, John's already up here. There's John. John Ledger, Jim Hauser, and Charles Wagner, please come forward. John, do you mind starting?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. This is a very kind of an esoteric topic, and I'll keep it as brief as I can, and DEQ can kind of fill you in on some of the details. What we have across the country are areas sometimes going into non-attainment for ozone. Ozone is really not emitted much by anything. It's a result of nitrogen oxides and hydrocarbons that cars emit a lot, because we have a lot of cars, even though they're a lot cleaner. And right now, the Portland area is in attainment for ozone. We're not violating the standard, but we're close. And in about a year and a half, the standard is going to get much more tight. We know that. We don't know how tight. And the state has to have a plan called a maintenance plan that keeps us in attainment so we're not violating the ozone standard. And if you have the standard about here, and you're kind of going along here below the standard, this little space between where you are and where the standard is the amount of air quality you can use up. And the tighter you get to that standard, or the lower the standard gets, the harder it is to get a permit to build anything and the tighter the controls are. Once you go over the standard, which is a risk, and you go into non-attainment, the result would be something that would be economically worse, offset just about anything you're doing in here to help the economy. You go into non-attainment, and the area would probably run from Salem up through Portland, maybe down the gorge. And the state has to come up with a way to bring you into attainment, and it would involve things like having extraordinarily stringent controls on industries that want to expand or build. Not only would they have to put on the lowest emission rate conceivable in the nation, they would have to reduce the amount by 120% from other places. It would mean that companies that you drive by every day that do coatings and paintings and sheet metal work that use solvents or maybe have boilers, they wouldn't be able to use the products they're using now because many would be banned, including sales of things like some paints and stains. When you go into non-attainment for ozone, like in California, there are certain shapes of gasoline cans like you'd use to fill up your lawnmower that are illegal. You can only buy certain shapes because it might fall over and spill gasoline. That's part of their attainment plan. It's very rigorous, so it's not something we want to get to trigger in any way. Cars are the major source of ozone precursors, and though maybe only 7% fail, but we have a lot of cars. And 7% of a lot of cars is a bunch of cars. And then you multiply that by what the emissions might be, and then you have to calculate that into where you are in relation to the standard. And that's something that involves a lot of work. And the reasonable thing we would propose before anything is changed on the inspection and maintenance program is to say, what would the result be? Does it get us closer to being a non-attainment or further? What are the projections over the years, and what is it likely to mean if the standard is changed? So what we would urge would be before the legislature imposes something on this would be to ask the agency to come in and tell you, frankly, these are our options and these what it means to the industrial sector, the commercial sector, and just people's living day to day. And then we can make an informed decision on this. Thank you.
Thank you. John, make sure, are you aware of the potential amendment at this point?
I am indeed, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Make sure of that. Any other questions for John?
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. John, I'm curious if and this may be a question for the department, if a region does not submit a plan or an agreed-upon plan to bring a region back into attainment, what happens?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, committee, I can tell you exactly, because although I'm hesitant to admit this, at one time I was a regulator, and I actually had Mr. Ginsburg's job in another state. And we did non-attainment plans. And when you go into non-attainment, you have to submit an attainment plan under federal law that meets the standard. If you do not, in the end, you will lose your highway funds.
Thank you.
Your previous occupation explains a lot now that I think about it. Other questions? Not. Please, proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Charles Wagner. I'm a resident of Hillsborough, and I came down here today to testify because I've been waiting for somebody to take on this 10-year or 20-year out-of-date program for a very long time. I'm going to slightly contradict one thing that I've heard here today, that 7% of the vehicles are not passing. Those are the official statistics. Those include vehicles with transitory errors on their computers. And I don't think you can find the statistic for the actual number of vehicles that are producing emissions that are out of specification. I would certainly encourage you to ask the DEQ to provide those statistics. A more interesting statistic that you might be wanting to ask DEQ is, what is the proportion of vehicles failing that are less than 10 years old? The last time I checked that figure, it was less than 0.1%. And you have to ask yourself, in any program, if it is actually achieving anything when you have been going along for this long and you've been in attainment the whole time. Aside from the fact that I have a degree in chemical engineering from Oregon State University, I was a atmosphere control monitoring and maintenance officer on a nuclear submarine. I was a design and project engineer of continuous monitoring equipment for more than 5 years. And whenever your equipment is monitoring really low levels of non-compliance, you have to ask yourself if you are accomplishing anything at all. I don't think it takes rocket science or engineering calculations to conclude that there is a reasonable chance that you are producing more pollution than you are saving when less than 7% or less than 0.1% of the vehicles you are measuring are detecting anything awry. So I would encourage you to insist that the DEQ not only provide you with the statistics of what things would look like if you didn't have this program, I would encourage you to ask them what is being produced by all those vehicles driving to and from the monitoring stations, waiting in line for 15 minutes or 20 minutes to be monitored, and how much you would save on emissions by eliminating that or going with another type of program such as a spot monitoring program. What you want to do is catch the miscreants that are not maintaining their vehicles, not cause 96 or 98 or 99.9% of the public to drive down to an emission monitoring station and wait in line. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions at this point? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier, Mr. Ledger indicated that 7% of vehicles, I think, failed to pass the test. And I don't necessarily expect him to know the answer. Maybe he does. But he also indicated that in a year and a half, we expect the standards to be tightened considerably. And I'm wondering if DEQ or possibly Mr. Ledger can extrapolate based on current data, what percentage of the vehicles would be expected to fail in a year and a half's time when the standards change?
Before he answers, I'm eager for your answer, John. And you know, we do have DEQ in the room too, so we'll
yes.
make sure we bring that
Thank
up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
I believe, and Mr. Ginsburg will correct me, it's kind of an indirect mechanism, and that is you would look at what the new standard is, and then you'd kind of you'd do an emission inventory of all the sources of NOx and hydrocarbons within the area, and then you would back calculate to what the total mass of emissions of NOx and VOCs could be from the automobiles, and then you would back calculate to what would be an acceptable limit there, and it may. You know, maybe that nothing needs to be done. Maybe something else needs to be done. We just don't know. The whole point is we need to find out before we take any more actions.
Please, one more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, you indicated that, in essence, I think that if we're not maintaining ozone levels from automobiles, that any excess would have to be taken up perhaps by industry, I think was the point you were making.
Yeah, it's an accounting issue. And what happens when you go into a non-attainment, when you go into non-attainment if you're a small commercial operation, it's going to affect what products you can make and use in your coatings, paintings, platings, the kind of boiler you might use because that's a source of NOx. If you're a large operation, it's going to affect the controls that you're going to have to retrofit. Or if you want to expand or locate here, it has a big effect. And the way the system works, you have a level, it's kind of like olives. You know, you have colossal, jumbo, all these different sizes. So if normally the controls you would need might be what are called reasonably available control technology, the next step up from that is best available control technology, and then you go better than that, which is maximum available control technology, and then the one better than that is LEER, or lowest available emission rate, which is like whatever, the cost doesn't matter, it's the best in the universe. So you put that on, and then if you're going to emit 100 tons with that, then you have to go to somebody else and get a reduction of 120 tons. So it causes this spiraling up of controls, and it becomes very difficult to expand or locate in something. Plus, the entire area would have a federal designation that it has unhealthful air, which isn't great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I don't know, well, I do know that we in this state and federally as well expect industry to perform at a level that is very high standards in terms of air pollution, air quality standards. And I am just wondering if we increase the burden on industry, as you've suggested, whether you anticipate any adverse employment impacts among any of the employers in this state.
Well, on balance, Mr. Chairman, Representative, what anything you do that makes it harder to permit and harder to expand is going to have an impact on jobs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for that answer. And Mr. Hauser. Welcome and identify yourself, and we're looking forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. Thank you very much. My name is Jim Hauser, and I have provided written testimony, so I'm not going to bother to read through that. My business is Hawthorne Auto Clinic in Southeast Portland. I'm here representing both my company and also the Northwest Automotive Trades Association and its 500 members. My wife, Liz Daly, and I started Hawthorne Auto Clinic 29 years ago. We are a full-service mechanical repair shop, and we are both a DEQ-recognized repair facility and a Washington DOE certified auto repair facility, so we have extensive experience with both programs. First, I'd like to emphasize that cars and trucks still account for a significant proportion of air pollution problems. In Oregon, more cars are driving more miles, and an important statistic is people are keeping their cars longer, which means more of their components, including emission control components, are failing. And that means a greater likelihood of emission problems. The modern cars and trucks are very clean, but that is only true as long as the advanced equipment is working properly. As those components break down, then they need maintenance or repair. Most of our failure-related work is performed before the cars actually ever go to DEQ. Most everybody knows in this state that if your check engine light's on, you're going to fail. So as soon as they get the notice that their car is due for relicensing, they, if that check engine light's on, they make a call and before they ever go in. So I believe the statistic, the 7% statistic or the 0.1%, does not represent the actual failure rate, because most people are smart enough to know you don't go in there with the problem. You get it fixed before you go in. So it's clear to me that many motorists would never have arrived at our doorstep to begin with if the emission test requirement wasn't there. I think that if the legislature is considering abandoning the Oregon way of conducting vehicle emission testing, I'd like to point out some of the current advantages that Oregonians have over, for example, the state of Washington. In the state of Oregon, you don't pay for the test. You pay for the certificate. So if your car is failing, and if you either want or need to fix it yourself, you can go to the test station. You'll get the test report. You can solve the problem. If necessary, you can go through however many times it takes, and you don't pay until you get the certificate. In the state of Washington, you pay when you drive up. If you fail the test, unless you take it to a place that's authorized by the state of Washington, you continue to pay each time you go in. There's no provision. The test is, you pay for it each time. The Oregon VIP tests older cars, cars that are older than the state of Washington tests. Those are the cars that are typically the ones that at least have the potential for higher emissions. And so that would certainly need to be taken into consideration if you're going to consider going with a Washington type of program. The other point that's harder to calculate, but in my experience, the Oregon test centers, the test site staff, are incredibly helpful. And if a customer comes in and they've lost their certificate, we can call up the test centers and they'll fax us another one. If we have a car that's giving us problems getting through, they're perfectly happy to open up a test lane for us to go out there and make sure that we've got the problem solved. None of those, I've never tried, the way in Washington, if you need a duplicate test, as you call your state the representative for DOE, they call the test center, and then the test center sends them the report, and then the report comes to us. But there's no provision for us going to the test site over in Vancouver to work out a problem with a car, because we'd have to pay each time we take the car through the test site. So my own opinion, and EPA is currently preparing to release new air quality standards. A vehicle emission testing program has the greatest chance of success when it's flexible and perceived by the public to be responsive and dynamic program. It will need to have the ability to adapt to new technologies, new air quality standards mandated by EPA, and problems discovered by the manufacturers, which the DEQ is very easy to work with when we discover problems, especially in the transition to 1996-97 model years. Since 1975, DEQ has been able to successfully manage all of these challenges. An Oregon-run DEQ program has the greatest chance of success with the best short and long-term benefits to Portland and Medford's air quality and to the motoring public's consumer satisfaction. Finally, I'll share a comment from one of my emission repair techs, because we had a meeting at the shop to talk about what do you think about going with the Washington program, because we do both programs. And one of my emission techs said, why would anyone want to shoot a running horse? So that pretty much mirrors my sentiments. I think we have an excellent program. It's a unique program, unlike any other state has, and I think we should continue to do it the Oregon way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hauser. Mr. Hauser, this is, I think you're in my old neighborhood. I'm just trying to place where Hawthorne Repair is. Auto Clinic, I should say.
You familiar with Common Grounds Coffee House?
Yes.
We're right. Our parking lot is in between. Yeah.
Good. And well, you're well represented here. And
yes.
there'll probably be other questions. But I did want to make a comment, and maybe it's not really a question, but clearly advanced technology doesn't negate maintenance. Point well taken. But I'm wondering, and I don't know how you would measure this, there's got to be some improvement, the technology itself, in our ability to improve air quality and lessen the need for the for their inspection. Don't you agree? I don't know to what degree, but somewhere in there, technology has to have helped us, yes?
Co-Chair Gilliam, yeah, technology has made huge advances. The technology is complex, and there's more and more of it. And so as long as all that technology is functioning as it's designed, it's much, much cleaner. Working in the shop, you can tell the difference, even though we have big exhaust hoses. It's when those components break down and have problems, yeah. then you go back to the problems you had before.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. As you teased out here, I want to welcome Mr. Hauser, who is a constituent, and his business has been operating in my district and creating jobs for quite a while. And you can trust what he says, because he's an honest mechanic, and I can tell you from experience, because when I got my Jeep diesel, I took it to him. And he said, it's not really my specialty. Why don't you take it to the mechanic down the street and give me a good recommendation? So,
did you notice a French fry smell when he drove in?
But I did actually have a serious point to make, too, as well. I had a previous vehicle that failed several times and didn't have to pay for those failures, and had found, eventually teased out the problem, that the computer system, while the vehicle was fine mechanically, the computer system needed a reboot. It had crashed like Microsoft Windows, I guess. How often do you see that in the technology, and even with these updated cars? Have you seen problems with computer systems?
Co-Chair Bailey, it depends on the manufacturer. There are some manufacturers that have significant problems. One of the big advantages to from about 2001 and on is most of the computers, unless they've really failed, can be reprogrammed. We have the capability to log into the car's computer, log into the manufacturer's website, and download the necessary patch or repair in many cases. Previously, you had to just buy another computer. There still are cases. We just this week had to buy a whole new computer for a Honda. So that certainly does happen. It's not as common as it used to be, fortunately. They are really improving that technology. But it also takes a shop that has the capability and the equipment to do that. Not everybody can do that.
I just comment, Mr. Co-Chair, that until there's an app for that, it sounds like having these services is really important to be able to identify it, to correct the problem, and to be able to take it to these shops. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to note that a sweltering summer day last summer, I had a check engine light come on when I was in the vicinity of Hawthorne Boulevard, and I was also in the heat of a campaign, and swung into Mr. Hauser's shop, and within a half hour, he had me back on the road, and I even made my appointment. Hawthorne Auto Clinic.
Energy, Environment, Water, and Small Business. We're happy you're here. Any other comments or questions about the shop or other issues? All right. I thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Wingard, I noticed our friend.
Yes.
I noticed our friend, Representative Esquivel. He's not coming back.
He's
not.
Okay. He took one look at the committee.
Yeah, that's all. We're not on the record now. So we will move on to Jana Gastelum. We'll bring up Peggy Lynch. And Ralph, this is not your handwriting on here. But you didn't write this, did you? All right, fine. You can come on. And Andy will note I'm saving him till last. Sit over there. In full disclosure, committee, is it a conflict of interest? Ralph and I are cousins, and I wanted everybody to be aware of that.
All right.
But you have to go last. Peggy, please.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I hope that you have each received our email that was just sent today on this particular matter. As written, we certainly oppose the bill. The League adopted positions on air quality in May of 1968. So we've cared about air quality for a long time. And it's really kind of fun to sit here and to be able to say, Mr. Ledger said just exactly what we were going to say. It's really important for Oregon businesses to make sure that we stay in attainment. Mr. Hauser said the third paragraph of our letter, which says that by encouraging the maintenance of our vehicles, many small business jobs are created. So that's equally important because, in truth, it is true. The program reminds us to be sure that our cars are ready for that next inspection. So rather than take too much of your time, I just would like to say that we certainly do oppose the bill. But I do want to say that I have heard that there is an amendment coming related to a report about how this program is working. The League loves reports. However, I am concerned about the cost to DEQ of the work. And so in this tight fiscal time, I want to be sure that there is an appropriate fiscal analysis done of whatever the amendment is to be sure that we're not putting a burden on DEQ right now. It's not that a report is not warranted and shouldn't happen at some point, but we're fighting for every penny we can get to keep DEQ working for Oregon businesses. And we want to make sure that that continues to happen. And when we're prioritizing spending, this is an important issue. So thank you very much.
Peggy, thank you for your testimony and for the email. We do have it.
Okay.
And it's an interesting point of view, and it's a kind of a hard one to evaluate because, you know, there's another side to the DEQ equation, which is at what point does a fairly old standard, and it may not be now, become onerous on, and we've heard two sides of that, onerous on either vehicle owners or business. But I appreciate the point of view, and I thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm a program director for the Oregon Environmental Council. I'm here also to voice opposition for 4112 as written, and also to raise concerns about the amendment. So we see this bill as being counterproductive to many of the state's goals, those being maintaining good air quality and also providing space for economic development in the state. OEC has partnered with business many times over the course of our history. We've helped find new markets for agricultural products that are produced sustainably, and we're happy to join with our business and industry colleagues in raising concerns about eliminating this program. And the way I've been thinking about this is we can think about our airshed as kind of a series of boxes. And our ozone or smog box is only so big. And how we fill that box determines what types of activities we can do in the state. And right now, how we fill that box is shared amongst transportation, industry, and business. And if we eliminate a program for transportation, it means that we increase the responsibility on business and industry for maintaining that good air quality that's really necessary. And that air quality is important. Ozone contributes to things like asthma, and Oregon has an above-average burden of asthma. It cost the state $28 million in 2008. Nationally, asthma costs the nation $20 billion. It's expensive, it costs us in productivity, and it's something that we can control through smart, effective programs like Oregon's Vehicle Emission Inspection Program. I just want to give a couple of benchmarks. Right now, the size of that ozone box is 75 parts per billion. That's the current standard. EPA, by the end of 2013, is expected to reduce that box size down to between 60 and 70 parts per million, which is a good thing. Air quality is really important. And the areas that have vehicle emissions inspection programs are only the ones that are concerned about ozone air quality. That's the Portland area and the Medford areas. Those areas are averaged at about 65 to 70 parts per billion ozone. So you can see that we're right around those limits, and that if that ozone standard drops down to 60, we would be over the limit. If it drops to 70, we would be just barely at it. And as Mr. Ledger pointed out, maintaining a buffer is really important. We don't want to go out of attainment. It triggers restrictions on new and expanding business and industry. And if we're out of attainment for too long, it can also require additional restrictions on existing industry that are already maintaining their air quality share of the burden. So we like the Vehicle Emissions Inspection Program because it's been effective and it's efficient. It controls for all the types of pollution that help contribute to ozone. Those are hydrocarbons, NOxes, and carbon monoxide. One program, multiple pollutants. If you get rid of that program, you have to think about new programs to address maybe single-source pollutants. And that could increase complexity, and that could increase cost. The other thing is that there are other co-benefits from these types of programs. Mr. Hauser mentioned that well-maintained vehicles are better for consumers. There's a report by the Consumer Federation of America that says that repairs made after inspections have actually saved consumers 6 to 13% on their fuel costs. Better maintained car operates better, more efficiently. As a consumer, I actually appreciate that. We also just recently had to go in to get our car inspected. It took about 3 minutes. We were in and out and on our way. So I urge you to preserve this program. My last point is that the program employs 110 Oregonians in northern and southern Oregon. This isn't the time to think about putting those people out of work or all the other indirect jobs it creates for all of our other small business friends out there. Last but not least, 30 other states have these programs. Those that phase out the program, like Washington State, did so before it was announced that EPA would increase these standards. I don't think it's unreasonable to think that states that have phased out programs might actually think about reinstating them because of new ozone standards. So I think we have a good program in place. We shouldn't fix what ain't broken. Thank you.
Any questions so far? Seeing none. Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME. Those who are new, that's American Federation of State county municipal employees. I do represent everything from DEQ to Metro, so my conflict would be I'm the one union in the building that does represent energy interests, clean automobiles, and so forth. So that's my conflict. I happen to love it. I'm not as articulate as this wonderfully bright young lady, and I want to compliment you. She taught me some nuances I appreciate. Let me be quick. I just testified next door and was told I'm due it next door. I have got, for once, I had to work. And I've been involved with the vehicle inspection program since its inception. I'm probably one of the few here in this building that has been. And I have to tell you that the cards we hand out for public opinion should have been brought up. It's overwhelming. Over 85, 90% of the people in the metro area that have their vehicle inspection appreciate the employees, how they're treated courteously, and how they've been handled. We used to turn those in since we had doubtful legislators, and we brought them in buckets. But the fact is, whether that's important or not, I think that one, it attributes itself to how they're treated by our members, who are my members of my particular union, to provide this service. I would mention that one of the things John Ledger talked about, I had to learn years ago from people like John. The fact is, to me, it's a bowl of soup, and a bowl of soup requires salt, pepper, vegetables, meat, whatever you like. But it also includes, in this case, vehicle inspection. That soup is stirred to perfection by EPA when we turn our management report in. And the fact of the matter is, as you take any one ingredient out, you must make up for the loss of that ingredient somewhere else. And what John was talking about is the fact of the matter, it can hurt business. I didn't say it would. But if it does, I don't know who else. I recall we've had this before. We had no other option but to pass that on to business. And I don't like that, even though I'm a labor guy, because I need people working rather than business paying higher fees, so that, in fact, I've got income tax coming in here to fund our various programs. So I want to thank business, not hurt them. It can reverse itself. Secondly, I'm glad the Oregon Environmental Council mentioned it, something I've worked on with DEQ for years. I haven't gotten far, but clean diesel and clean air. I can tell you that we didn't have the funds for a monitor in Clackamas, in Portland Metro, to monitor the air. Finally, you gave them a monitor last session because it was critical. I can also tell you that the air pollution comes out of where we all live, and only one, two, three of us live there. And the fact is that air we breathe goes is the worst pollution for years has been in Caris, because it goes from your neighborhood when the wind's right out to the country. So it doesn't just impact those of us paying fees when we impacts their health. You said asthma. I happen to have statistics. We also have OHSU, our members. The fact is, the largest concern we have is the increase in asthma. Oregon, one of the fastest. That applies to the health committee, who was here. And the fact of the matter, our cancer rate, especially lung cancer and heart. All of these things are directly attributable to air pollution. And if we can't reduce it, then in fact we're going to see and are seeing extremely high cost at the health care committee, I think, out of hearing these kinds of issues. So in the end, I appreciate what you're doing and what you've heard. One of the arguments I hear is we've got to reduce the amount of regulation in Congress and here. I don't view this as regulation on business. This was how we came along. By the way, some in this building think this is general fund. I pay for it. This is totally funded by fees. Those of us who live in the area who are willing to have our car inspected pay the fee. As a matter of fact, we paid 10 years in advance, and I had a legislator from my district try to take all our money from that pot, and I found out, in fact, that was so we didn't have to increase the fees for 10 years. And then last session, they swept about $3 million. That's what we call it here. You'll learn that. They sweep it. They don't take it of the fees that we have in our program. So, bottom line, this is a program that at the very least I would hope you could delay until EPA comes out with their new standards in 2013 so that we can look at this, because if we prematurely take this away as one of our arrows in our toolbox, okay? The fact is you may have done more harm, one, to business, to air quality that is already suffering in the Portland metro area. And frankly, if we're going to fix it, yes, we're getting to electric, hybrids, all of those. But if you look at the cost of those cars, at least for the folks I live in that were just laid off at our mill in Oregon City, Mole Alamo, they're not in it, but that's my neighborhood. They frankly can't afford a new electric car, and they can't even afford a new hybrid. What they're going to have to do is keep their car 15 to 20 years, and they are. And those are the polluters on the road today. Thank you for the time you've given this particular person, and particularly, thank you for letting me listen to people who really know what they're talking about.
And you claim not to be articulate. Fine testimony, Ralph.
We'll find out how articulate he is and how knowledgeable he is. You're quoting the increase of cancer and asthma. If you go look, you'll find out the increase of marijuana tracks it exactly in this state.
Yeah. Yeah. Diesel, by the way, is our big problem, big problem, but that's a separate issue. It's clean diesel. Someday we'll clean it. Thank you.
Are there other comments or questions for this panel?
I have a comment, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. And, you know, I had no idea you were related because Ralph goes back to the beginning. He was one of the first people I met in this process, and he's very modest. He used to sit on this side of things, too, so... He's been around the block a few times. And I have to say, you know, I could just hear some rap music going on with all those hand gestures. I think we have the video right here from Ralph Groner for this short session.
Thank you very
too
much.
Nice.
Representative Witt.
Top that.
He's coughing. He's got the asthma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ralph, I think the testimony was somewhere in the neighborhood of 110 workers. I don't know if they're all your members or not.
They are.
Involved in this industry. Can you give me a rough idea of what the average wage rate for those folks would be?
Boy, that's a rep. That's a, what your job is, a business rep. But you could ask Andy Ginsberg is here to answer that, okay? They have health coverage so that when they get these diseases, we can make sure they're taken care of. Decent salaries. We do that. Try to provide that in the union movement. And they have a decent pension. Well, they will have for at least.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're a full service rep.
Well, exactly.
Just to go back quickly, since you brought up those diseases, I wanted to ask you something about the what you called the burden of asthma. And I'm just curious, is the burden, were you referring to factors that have caused asthma or that we have a disproportionate amount of asthma sufferers?
We have a disproportionate amount of asthma sufferers, especially our adult asthma rate. So when we compare ourselves nationally, we're considered to have a higher than above average burden of asthma in our state.
And where, you don't have to cite it exactly, but where does that sort of statistic or idea come from?
There was a report by the Oregon Health Authority called The Burden of Asthma in Oregon.
Thank you. That's helpful. Other questions or comments for this panel? If not, we thank you for your testimony. Representative Holvey, we have one more person to testify. Are you okay time-wise? Because I don't want to disrespect your time.
I'm fine. Yeah, I was actually thinking about talking about fine particulates, too. But
yeah, that's what I was worried about. Andy, if you can, to the best of your ability, in addition to the testimony you've prepared, touch on some of the things that we've tossed your way, fairly or unfairly. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, and I'm here to provide some additional information about House Bill 4112 and to express our concerns as well. Much of what's covered in my testimony has been said, so I'm going to just make a couple of additional points. First of all, DEQ is agrees that we need to regularly evaluate our emission reduction strategies to make sure that they're still effective and needed. And as one example, I can tell you that we repealed a requirement to add oxygenated fuel to gasoline in the winter after our monitor showed that carbon monoxide levels had fallen to the point where they were no longer needed. And we plan to assess the need for the vehicle inspection program as well as part of our update to the ozone plan, as you've heard several speakers talk about. And you've also heard people mention about how EPA is planning to come out with a new standard next year. We're in the middle of a 10-year plan to keep in compliance with the ozone standard. We'll be updating that plan and coming out with a new long-term plan for ozone. So from our perspective, the best time to do this analysis is after we know the new standard and as we are in the process of developing the long-term plan, the next long-term plan, so we don't duplicate effort. The analysis that we have to go through as part of putting an ozone plan together is quite complex. You heard Mr. Ledger talk about inventorying all of the emission sources. There are literally hundreds of different sources of air pollutants that contribute to ozone. Vehicles are significant, but there are many others. And we put together an inventory, and then we have to do a computer model using a three-dimensional photochemical grid model, because as you heard, ozone is primarily not emitted directly. It's a photochemical reaction in the atmosphere. We have to project growth and so forth. It's a very complex and costly analysis, and so we try to look at it comprehensively and look at all the strategies at the same time. We are also innovating and working on new technologies. We don't want to have everyone drive to our stations if it's not necessary. We were the first state in the nation to start testing the onboard computer rather than testing the tailpipe of the car. And that technology has allowed us to come up with other innovations. We invented a self-service test center, a testing booth where you can actually test your own car and get a registration out of a vending machine. Right now, we have one operating, and we're building a second one, and our idea is ultimately to have this more available, potentially even allowing people to transmit data over the internet so there's no driving involved. So those are the types of advances that we're working on. We'll be looking at the need for the vehicle inspection program in part of the broader context. Our problem is since it's costly and it takes a while to do, we really couldn't get it done in time for the 2013 session. Probably the ozone standard won't be finalized until towards the end of 2013 or later. What we'd like to do is do the analysis after we know the standard and as we're preparing the next long-term plan. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, the challenge here, I guess, is taking a bunch of non-engineering types like us and explaining to us how we would gauge that which the department's doing and whether or not any part of it could be changed to save the folks in Portland money or wherever the tests are being done. And so when I look at what I see here in your report, which I think is very nicely done, there's four or five things that go to air quality, there's four or five things in the report, but there's only one that really goes to quality. The rest goes to what the EPA is demanding of us. And so let me ask just a couple of general questions with that background. First, how much space is there between where we are now when it comes to air quality and where we would have to be if we were violative of it? And let's just use the airshed up in Portland. And do it as a percentage, if you could.
Okay. Co-chairs, Representative Benz. We are the level of ozone does change year to year because it depends on how hot and sunny the weather is. When the weather is over 90 degrees for a couple of days in a row and wind speeds are below 5 miles per hour and it's sunny, we form more ozone. So if you look at the data over a long period of time, you'll see a cyclical pattern when we have cooler summers and warmer summers. And that superimposed on that pattern will be a trend that depends on emissions. So it's a complex question, but I'll say that we are over the last you know, the last decade, the levels in the Portland and Medford area have hovered between 65 and 70 parts per billion. The current standard is 75 parts per billion. And as you heard, EPA is considering a range between 60 and 70 parts per billion. So we'll, if they lower the standard to 70 parts per billion, we'll be at 90-plus percent of the standard. If they lower it to 65, we'll probably be violating the standard.
Follow up.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the automobile is what percentage of that ozone picture?
Co-chairs, Representative Bentz, it depends on which pollutant you're talking about. As you heard, ozone is formed primarily, the primary pollutants involved in forming ozone are hydrocarbons and nitrogen oxides. Carbon monoxide also plays, and as well as other chemicals. The main two being nitrogen oxides. Motor vehicles account for over half of the emissions of nitrogen oxides, and for hydrocarbons, about a third. Those percentages will change over time as, you know, new cars phase in, as other emission sources grow. Right now, that's about where we are.
Follow up. I don't think you heard the answer in there. The question is, of the total range of pollutants that generate the ozone issue, what percentage is made up of automobiles, and what percentage is something else? Or is it all automobiles?
Co-chairs, Representative Bentz, no, it's not. It's definitely not all automobiles. I don't know that I can, off the top of my head, say combine the pollutants together, but when we're looking at hydrocarbons, about a third from automobiles, more from other types of engines like construction equipment and, you know, lawn and garden equipment, so forth. Additional emissions of hydrocarbons from industry that uses, as Mr. Ledger said, solvents and paints and coatings and things like that. When we're talking nitrogen oxides, it's primarily engines and boilers. Cars make up over half of the nitrogen oxide emissions, but there are other significant sources as well from transportation. So. I'm sorry, I can get back to you with more information, but I can't really combine all the pollutants together.
That's fine. Let's assume it is 30%. So that means that this particular bill is going to address 30% of the ozone issue, and that means there's another 70% that your department should be doing something about, because that's where most of the solution apparently would rest. So let me just, this is another general question, but I would like to know, when it comes to all the money that's being spent to control, if you will, these types of emissions, can you tell us, is it about 30% of these fees add up to about 30% of the total? I want to see if there's some rational relationship between the outcomes and the amount you're spending, we're spending on this.
Yeah. Co-chairs, Representative Bentz, we're at 30% now because of all of the investment that industry has already made to reduce their emissions. You heard Mr. Ledger talk about reasonably available control technology and best available control technology. All of that is in place, and the expenditures have been made for that, and that's what brings the industrial emissions down and leaves the vehicle emissions at 30% of the hydrocarbons. And so the next increment of reduction that industry would have to make would cost a lot more. I can't tell you off the top of my head the exact amount that industry has invested to get to that level, but I know it's been significant.
Final follow-up.
Yes,
it seems to me that, and I know these are complex and expensive exercises, and I understand that you're generalizing in your answers. So, I guess I would want to know how the department determines who is going to focus upon when it comes to enforcement, because without the answer to the question I just asked, I don't know how you'd prioritize, and you have to prioritize. So, is there a report that shows us how the department is prioritizing its enforcement efforts, and thus how important this 30% is to that entire, and you know where it fits and why you would focus on cars because, right, gee, it's more expensive otherwise. So just maybe you can bring us up to speed on how you would best, where I would find the answer to what I just asked.
Okay. Co-chairs, Representative Bentz, when we put together the ozone plan or any air quality plan, we do it with an advisory committee. In this particular case, and the committee would involve members of the public, members of business, local governments. And in this particular case, we had a bill that started the analysis where we established a task force to reduce emissions in the Portland area. The report from that came back to the legislature and was adopted as a suite of strategies that the department was directed to implement for the ozone plan. Many, many more advisory committees were, met to come up with the details of those plans. And the final analysis is included in a comprehensive document called our ozone maintenance plan that's submitted to EPA. And I'd be happy to get you a copy of that. It shows all the plans, all the strategies that are in the ozone plan. But I think what you're asking is, how do we decide whether we're going to add an additional regulation to motor vehicles or to businesses if we need to reduce emissions? And that's through the advisory committee process. What we will do is, through our analysis, we'll identify, here's the amount of additional emission reductions that is needed, or if more reductions are needed. We will identify what all the options are, looking at, every source category that emits, what the different technologies are. That could reduce those emissions. What is the cost per ton of emissions to reduce that? How could it be implemented? Do we have the authority to require it? Could it be done through a voluntary means? And all of that is put in front of an advisory committee, and we rely on the discussions in the advisory committee to select the final suite of strategies and try and make it something that fits within the objectives and culture of that local community.
Mr. Chair, I have a comment. Thank you for that, Andy. It seems to me that the bill, in order to tailor it in a way that fits what we just heard, requires a great deal of, I'm going to call, interworking. So I'm happy to hear that they were, the sponsors, working with you in making this bill fit what we just heard. Because it's been my observation that unless you are an air quality engineer, this is quite challenging to do anything with productively. So, thank you.
Andy, you're not in charge of the entire DEQ budget, but the thing that concerns me about Representative Bent's question is it possible that we are spending an inordinate amount of resources on a significant, but 30% of what the problem is? I don't know if you can answer that very quickly, but it's an issue that I think is kind of hanging there when you think about retooling or reevaluating this age-old program.
Co-Chair Gilliam, I can tell you that I can't say if it's inordinate, but I can say that we have reduced it significantly in the mid 90s. We added a new test to our vehicle inspection program that required vehicles to be driven onto a treadmill or a dynamometer and run it under load at acceleration and deceleration with a complicated test of the tailpipe. And it was a very, very effective test, but it was high maintenance and it required 3 inspectors for each car that was being tested. And when we switched to testing the onboard computer of the vehicles, we were able to reduce that to 1 inspector per lane. So we cut our costs by 3, and that's the reason that we haven't had to raise the fees since 1996 or 1997. And in fact, we were able to lower the fee recently in Portland by $2 per certificate, at least for the next 2 years, despite having had a sweep in the past and potentially another. So. We have really been lowering the cost of the program quite a bit.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to that point, it might seem that regardless of the amount that you're spending on this particular program, that it is by definition always going to be somewhat more expensive on the margins to try to control pollution from 2 million different sources than it is to control from 50 different sources. And so I'd imagine that it's a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison between these two things. And if I understand the previous testimony correctly and what you're saying, that industry has already invested an enormous amount of money because it is so easily regulated and inspected to bring down the cost of emissions, and that the marginal benefit out of increasing that regulation is much more expensive than perhaps to the economy in general than the regulation in the motor vehicle sector would be to the economy in general. Is that sort of an accurate statement of where we're at?
Co-Chair Bailey, that is accurate in the broad sense. You know, if we looked at a specific example, there may be other cost-effective investments that could be made on reducing industrial emissions. But with regard to ozone, I think you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
Representative Wendt, I'm sitting here trying to remember what we wanted to get. We asked John Ledger, what did we want to get back to Andy on your question?
I think I wanted, Mr. Chairman, to find out what the average wage rate would be for someone in the pollution regulation industry. I think Mr. Groner said that there was, I think, in the neighborhood of 110 employees engaged in that industry, and should we lose that, that would be one consideration, a loss of a significant job base, and I was just wondering what kind of jobs with what kind of wage rate and benefits we might be looking at losing.
Okay. Co-chairs, Representative Witt, I don't have the actual salary. I could certainly get that to you right after this hearing. The classification of our inspectors is called a vehicle emission technician one, and that's most of the inspectors. It's comparable to a secretary type salary, or it's comparable to a salary that a DMV field office person might have. So it's not on the higher end of salaries. In fact, it's really on the lower end for DEQ. But it is it is an important source of income and benefits for those people. Oh, and I actually have it here. It's $15 per hour.
Very significant. And also, Mr. Chairman, I had asked the question if we were able to possibly project based on the data that we have. We know that 7% of autos are failing roughly presently emissions tests. When the more stringent EPA regs kick in a year and a half, if we could project what percentage of vehicles we would anticipate failing at that point.
Co-Chairs, Representative Witt, when EPA changes the standard, it won't change the failure rate of the vehicles. It'll change the amount of air pollution that's allowed in the airshed. So the test for vehicles is really designed around how those cars were built initially. A new car is held to a higher standard than an old car, and basically the computerized test really looks at each component of the vehicle that's involved in reducing the emissions to determine if it's working or not. And so new cars have a lot more components, as you heard from Mr. Hauser. There's a lot more things that are being checked. And the question is just, are they broken or are they working? And if they're broken, the car fails and it just had that item fixed. So when EPA changes the air quality standard, it won't change the failure rate, but it will change the total amount of air pollution that's allowed.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Witt. Andy, unless there are other questions or comments for you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that if eventually there is a report, perhaps after the EPA new standards, it seems like it would be really important to try to get at your question, and maybe you already do this, to take into consideration all of the repairs that, for instance, Mr. Hauser's group are doing, because if they weren't being done, what would the cost of cars that were emitting, what would that be? That would have to be taken into consideration in addition to the 7%. So I'm assuming you'd probably do that already. But I think the other calculation that would be interesting is if there's any way that you can tell from the things that were cleared up how much gas was saved. Because since the fund, this is not paid with general funds, but is paid by fees by consumers, presumably there'd be a little bit of a savings to those consumers in gas saving. Now, maybe that's really insignificant, but I just think it would be an interesting thing to put into the report.
I'd be happy to do that.
I'm not mandating that. I'm just thinking that those are different pieces of the pros and cons of cost. And
co-chairs, we would be happy to come back and report on when EPA's new standard comes out, what the level is. If we need to put a new plan together, what our progress is. If you know, as we update the plan to let you know what kind of strategies we're considering removing or adding from the program, we're happy to provide any information that you'd find interesting.
I guess lastly is just a quick update or mention of the amendment. Co-Chair Bailey and I will confer, but in the event that we do proceed, in your view, we're close, that's something we could resolve quickly regarding the amendment, or what?
Well, Co-Chair Gilliam, one concern that I have is whether we'll have enough information by 2013 to provide a meaningful report. We can certainly give you an update, but I don't think that EPA will come out with a new standard before the end of the 2013 session, and they've announced they're going to do it in 2013. My experience with EPA is that means sometime between late 2013 and mid-2014. So we may not have more to say then than we have now. Once we have the new standard, it will still take us, probably about a year to do the technical analysis. These are not simple models to run, and so I just don't know if it would be timely to come back. Certainly we have the progress report, but a full-blown analysis, we would have to really accelerate and do this analysis before we have the information, and then duplicate that effort again later when we have it.
Thank you for that. Thank you for coming today, and we're going to, for the time being, close the public hearing on House Bill 4112. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4060 and ask our colleague, Representative Holvey, if he'll come and kick us off. And I've got four other testifiers as well. Please.
Tom's limited to 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
3 minutes.
Yeah.
That's what we do in our committee.
I didn't know you were going to go down there and represent.
I'm just full of surprises,
all right.
Mr. Chair.
You two decide who's going first.
So, with your permission, I will kick this off. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And last year, Representative Holvey, my good colleague from Eugene, came to me and asked if we worked on some similar legislation and had some last-minute glitches. Otherwise, it would have sailed through with flying colors. So here we are back again. And because I was incapacitated at the time, I asked him if he could take the lead on it. And he basically, I'm the, what do you call it, the virus? I'm just the carrier, so to speak. So I gave him one of my bills. He did all the work, so you can give all the kudos to him and also all your questions to him. But I'm happy to sponsor this bill with Representative Holvey. And so please, if you have any tough questions, he gets them. Otherwise, I can take half the credit. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holvey.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee members, for allowing a public hearing on House Bill 4060. I'm hoping that because she's the carrier, I'm not the virus.
And you said that wrong, sorry.
And I won't talk about fine particulates, but it's a fascinating subject that
I spent some
time on, too. But I am here to talk about something that it is of great interest, I think, and really is something that we need to pay attention to, I think. And so I'm hoping that with that, you'll keep an open mind about this subject. Since last session, many of you will remember I brought a bill forward to deal with fish. And the bill's been refined. I've worked with people from the fishing industry, with ODF&W, trying to get the language right so that we don't have unintended consequences in this bill. And that's represented in the -1 amendments to this bill, which are, if you see, it's essentially a replacement of the bill. This bill, does not impact triploids. We've exempted them. It does not impact shellfish. It does not impact cattle. This bill is about fish, and it's about protecting our wild stocks of Pacific salmon. That's what this bill is about. Since last session, some of the things that had spurred me on to bring this forward last session have actually appeared in the news. With my testimony that's being passed out to you, there is some documentation of some articles about infectious salmon anemia, which has been found in the Pacific for the first time. And, you know, it's an alarming disease. It's had major impacts in different countries, Norway, Chile, Scotland. Just, you know, this is a bad disease that can have major impacts, and it's a virus. And one thing we know about viruses is that they do mutate, and that should hopefully wake us up to the potential threat that this disease and other viruses could cause to our wild strings of fish. I believe that we need to take action on this. I think the action is needed to minimize the risk to the health of our Pacific salmon stocks. Waiting for this disease to appear, I fear, will be too late. And it could have devastating impacts, not just to our Pacific salmon, but to a wide range of our economy. Our fishing industry is really a vibrant industry, and we ought to be focusing on bringing back those and keeping those Pacific salmon as strong as we can. They're really essential. We spend millions of dollars on habitat restoration and trying to protect our fisheries. And the impact of watching this Pacific salmon get impacted by a disease brought from essentially invasive species is really troubling. That impact could shut down more of our logging industry. It could shut down many aspects, as we well know, when the Endangered Species Act comes into play. So I really think we need to pay attention to this. I won't read you my testimony. I know that Co-Chair Gilliam always likes me to read my testimony.
I'm getting over it.
But I'll you know, forego that. I did put together, like I said, some other documentation. The state of Alaska, the U.S. senators and representatives, both Republican and Democrat from the state of Alaska, are really trying to push this issue at the national level as well. They see the threat that seems to be coming from the farming of Atlantic salmon in British Columbia and in the state of Washington as a very real threat to the whole Pacific stock of wild salmon. The case is also true with the genetically engineered fish. Their ability to basically get disease and carry it is something that you know, our native stocks are not used to, and I really fear that we're on the brink of a disaster if we don't try to take action to mitigate those risks. You know, could walk through the bill, but I'm hoping that Ed Bowles from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who helped me with this language, can answer some of the technical questions to the language. I can probably take a shot at them, but for that, I'm hoping that you can wait for that. I'm hoping that you'll keep an open mind, listen to the testimony, and if, in fact, you think we should take action, I've asked Representative Boone if it would be all right. I did have a letter printed up. If there's a majority of this committee, or the two Democrats and two Republicans that are willing to ask for a work session, there's still time to bring this bill to a work session and keep this bill alive. I think the conversation will get you there, I hope. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'd be more than happy to forego those questions and let other people testify. I'm sure there's some other people with a lot more expertise in this industry than I.
Well, thank you, Representative, for your testimony and your lesson in committee rules. And I think Representative Boone has a comment.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Paul, Representative Holby, for bringing this bill to my attention again. And I was happy to co-sponsor it, and especially since we made some of our fixes after last year's effort, and this really is only about salmon. And I wanted to point out that it has since come to our attention that some of these fish have been seen and caught offshore here, which means they've escaped from farms in either BC or Washington State. And everybody's watching for this. It's kind of an anemia, but it's a virus that's very damaging to the stocks, and we just can't afford to have that. And our coastal communities cannot afford to have any further risks to our stocks in wild salmon. And they have had problems in Norway and in Chile with this very disease, and it's kind of what I guess you could call it fish AIDS in a sense. It's very serious, and it's making its way around the world, and we just can't afford to have that happen. So subsequently, with the hard work of Representative Holvey and Legislative Council and Ed Bowles, Assistant Director of ODF&W and Salmon Commission people, they got the language pared down to basically just address this fish. So from what we understood, I talked with Pacific Seafood and some other people who had some concerns about it, and once they heard that certain things were removed from the language, they indicated that they would have no further problems with it. So I just wanted to let you know.
Thank you, Representative. And we need to move on with the testimony for the folks that are here. So,
and for the record, I'm State Representative Paul Holvey.
Thank you. It's like you've done this before. Tom Wolf, Jim Myron, and Bob Olson, will you come up for the next panel?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf, Chairman of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, representing Trout Unlimited here in the state, the largest cold water conservation group in the nation. I'm here to offer TU's support of HB 4060 and its -1 amendments. My testimony is being passed on right now, and so for expediency purposes and the fact that I want to get home to the sunny climes of Hillsborough as fast as possible, I will just say that this is a very good bill. The -1 amendments, I feel, answer some concerns that ODFW feels, and I'll just close by saying that infectious anemia is a major problem that is spreading, and unfortunately when they started producing so much more Atlantic farm salmon, it opened a lot of bad doors on things that could happen, and those bad doors could affect the fishing community here in Oregon and the wild native salmon. So I ask that this bill be given a work session. I think it's very important to do that. I think that the longer that we wait, this problem could rise very quickly. So we need to act quickly. We need to act now, and we need to do something on a very proactive scale. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom, for your testimony and your brevity. It's appreciated. And now, Bob.
Yeah,
Co-Chair. Bob, just a second. And I don't think Jim Myron's in the room, so... Yeah, our last testifier will be Barry Boucher. And Barry, you're welcome to come up now so you'll be in place for your testimony. Please, Bob.
Co-chairs, committee members, my name is Bob Olson with the Association Northwest Steelheaders. This bill, as it would be amended, is important. We favor the concept of carefully improving controls over genetically modified fish. And the measure should not be seen as another food genetics issue. It is really a different universe. And, for example, a major provision continues our state's fight against invasive species, and doing this at the front end of the process rather than the back end of the induction process. And so we encourage you to keep these issues and this bill high on your radar. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. We'll pause briefly for any questions of these two testifiers. If not, we'll ask Barry if you'll identify and give your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gillum, Co-Chair Bailey. I appreciate the opportunity to represent the Oregon Farm Bureau here today. Government agencies have not yet completed the regulatory process to improve any GE fish traits to date, and they are currently not available. This bill is a solution looking for a problem. I'm amazed we are spending the amount of time on this we are when it appears to be somewhat untimely. Philosophically, industry needs to embrace all technologies to produce food, especially considering the worldwide increase in demand for protein. These are triploid fish. I recognize that. They're sterile. They're fish that cannot spawn, and there is no genetic flow issue or gene transfer issue. Infectious salmon anemia virus is specific to Atlantic salmon, does not pose a risk to our northwestern salmonid population. regardless of that, its spread or virulence has absolutely nothing to do with genetic engineering. If I can be so bold, that is a red herring. Genetic fish have no more ability to transfer it or move it around than any other native fish. So the concept of genetic fish somehow in impacting the ability or the virulence of this process, I think is unnecessary and frankly ludicrous. Any public policy that bans a crop or a method of farming sets a terrible precedent. Interestingly, this bill would allow the importation of these very fish from other farms in other states. I believe there is enough uncertainty in this bill that it would be unlikely that the farmer would take the risk, and I think that is unfortunate. We just can't afford to be shipping farming opportunities out of our own state when there's few of them available here. Intended or not, I fear that this bill is another indirect means to send a message that genetic technology is bad. How sad that the state would take a position that singles out a crop or a production or a technology and ban it. Federal agencies are currently assessing the viability and the vitality of these traits in fish on a variety of facets, including environmental and economical. Let them do their work, see their results, and determine that at that time if there is any need for Oregon to draft separate state-centric policy. I serve at the request of Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack on the Advisory Committee on Biotechnology and 21st Century Agriculture. The Secretary recognizes the need for biotechnology. He also recognizes the need for developing strategies for coexistence. That's why this committee was formed. Farm Bureau embraces all forms and methods of farming. Don't preclude one of these options. More importantly, don't presume or pass a bill that presumes or lends a perception that this specific critical form of technology is somehow unacceptable. The facts simply don't support that. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Barry. Questions for Mr. Bashir? Representative Thompson.
We've heard comment here that these fish are already in the oceans, presumably from British Columbia. It seems to me that this is a federal issue or an international issue unless we can somehow get these fish to recognize Oregon's borders and know there's a prohibition before they cross them. I don't see how we're going to get where we want to go by passing a state law for something that British Columbia is doing. And if those fish are being released and coming to Oregon, I don't think we can prevent that with a bill.
May I respond?
Please.
Co-Chair Gillum, Representative Thompson, regardless of that, the fact remains that these are not traits currently available. If they are existing in the oceans, I don't know that. I've seen no proof of it. I don't know any evidence. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But if they are there, as I still maintain, they are incapable of gene transfer.
Right, I get that part.
I don't see the issue, but you're right. We already have a lengthy process in place that's recognized by federal agencies that deal with all new technologies, all pesticides, all pharmaceuticals. Let's let that process work. Let's not jump the gun here and spend time and effort and energy on the state's on the state's issue when so far it's not relevant.
Please.
Would this bill prevent a fish farm in Central Oregon spring fed from farming fish for commercial release, even if it's not on a stream flow?
Co-Chair Gillum, Representative Thompson, you certainly have to ask the authors of the bill of that. The way my confusion that I spoke of is it talks about, first of all, banning the farming of these fish in waters, and then it goes on later to exempt waters on private lands. But it precludes the transportation of those fish from the side of the pond. So if you were to try to raise these genetically modified fish in Central Oregon or my farm or anywhere else, my reading of the bill says you couldn't transport those fish to a processing facility unless you killed them first, which would then all automatically increase the cost of production of those fish and the cost of them to the consumer. And frankly, with the regulatory climate we live in now, you'd never be able to get the permits to build a processing plant on your farm, nor could you afford to do so for a handful of fish.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. We're going to ask Ed Bowles to come up. Mr. Bowles, we still have one other bill open, and so I'm going to ask you if you could. I'm sorry, Representative Witt, I forgot.
I can ask my question of Mr. Bowles.
Wonderful. If you'd give us a brief overview of your testimony, then I want to go to Representative Witt for a question, and also we can follow up on the question that Representative Thompson asked. So please.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I provided a brief written testimony, so I won't need to go through that. It describes what the bill actually does and doesn't do.
Colleagues, do you have that? Pardon me.
Everybody's got it?
Good.
And so basically, I'll just answer some questions. Our issue related to here is that this does prohibit genetically engineered fish in the state being propagated or released or transported within, but there are some key exceptions to that. Some of those exceptions are not technically genetically engineered, but it was just to avoid confusion. It also exempts the shellfish industry as well, and it does prohibit the propagation of Atlantic salmon, which is a known potential vector of the infectious salmon anemia virus that was referred to. This would not affect our programs, and I just mentioned that based on the prior question, this would have no impact on any current private trout production in the state. There is no genetic engineering that we are aware of within the state, and this would not preclude any of that in the central part of the state. Representative Thompson, those are all good to go under this bill.
And I'm going to get to Representative Witt. Just a little clarification. I'm sorry if we pulled the witness registration too soon. We got your name here. We got your testimony for the department. For, against, or neutral?
We have worked on the dash ones and support those. We are neutral overall on this issue.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me, Ed, if Atlantic salmon are capable of interbreeding with Northwest populations of salmon, indigenous salmon species?
Chair Gilliam and Representative Witt, no, we do not have hybrids of Pacific salmon and Atlantic salmon that occur in nature. That does not occur.
Okay. You mentioned that... The Atlantic salmon is a vector of disease. We had earlier testimony that said that no salmon species has greater powers of passing on disease than any other. I'm wondering if we've got the cart before the horse. Do we need to be looking at where that disease is acquired?
Chair Gilliam and Representative Witt, the disease in question on this is infectious salmon anemia. And as you heard from Representative Boone, that is something that has been devastating to the aquaculture. This is the fish farming in net pens in Norway, Chile, and other places. It is specific. It is a marine pathogen, and it is only been known to cause disease in Atlantic salmon. The reason I said that's the primary vector is that that is the most susceptible species to this particular pathogen. And that is why in this bill it deals with the potential for infectious salmon anemia, which is not yet present as a pathogen or a disease on the West Coast. Potential, if it does come, the vector for its amplification would be through Atlantic salmon, not through Pacific salmon. And so the precautionary approach to this bill is to avoid propagation of Atlantic salmon that we would perhaps get eggs from the East Coast or something and have those exposed to our Pacific salmon, because it's still an unknown regarding that. So far, Pacific salmon have not shown vulnerability to this particular virus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And were this to become a problem and we in any way reduced wild stocks of salmon in the Pacific Northwest, could you comment on the potential impact on the plan for Oregon salmon and watersheds and what that might mean for Oregon industry beyond and above the fishing industry?
Chair Gilliam and Representative Witt, the salmon and the industries they support, as you're well aware, are economically huge for the state. Anything that put their health at risk is something we would take extremely seriously, and it would have devastating consequences to our economy, particularly rural economies. We have a fish health policy and a fish health management portfolio that is very aggressive towards new pathogens and pathogens that are already in our waters. We the therapeutic approach is very rigorous and our testing is very rigorous. This particular virus would be one that we will be building in as a genetic lines. The cell lines for detection and surveillance of this are developed. We will be building them into our surveillance approach to keep these sort of things out. But this disease, if it should come into to our waters, is up there with other what we call Category 2 pathogens, of which we would be very concerned about. But this is not the only one. There are many that we are managing currently.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I would just like us to be able to get data on the fishing industry, particularly salmon, the number of jobs, the annual revenue, and what impacts disease could have on those numbers.
And could the department be helpful in those figures? We can also do something.
Chair Gilliam, we can provide information on the commercial, particularly with our salmon troll fishery, of which we have from our fish tickets, very real. It's more of a challenge to get at, as you're all well aware, the economics of the recreational salmon fishery. We can attempt to do that, Representative Witt. And if I need some clarification on what you're looking at, I will talk to you about it.
Good. And Mr. Chairman. You bet. And we'll get this started in terms of getting the information, and we'll be glad to circulate it to the committee. We're going to need to move on. I've got two waiting. So Vice Chair Krieger and then Chair Thompson, we need to move back to the bill we opened originally.
Mr. Chairs, does our staff measure summary, it doesn't include any of the dash one changes. So I'll ask Ed, how many fish do we have now in Oregon that aren't native? Off the top of your head,
Chair Gilliam, Representative Krieger, different species or actual individuals?
Well, black bass, crappies, four or five different kinds of cats.
Yeah, we have numerous species which are non-native, and I point out that the dash ones removed all reference in the bill to be excluding the sort of non-native language. So that is now gone in the bill.
That was what I was wondering. I hadn't tried to go through it. Because I know that it talks about prohibits the farming, cultivation, incubation of any species not native.
That is, Representative Krieger, that is no longer a part of the dash ones.
Okay. One other thing. I'll let that go for now.
Where are we going to be? Representative Thompson.
We seem to be concerned about a viral disease of Atlantic salmon and its potential effect on Pacific salmon. In section 2, for instance, sub A, it says import into or transport within the state any genetically engineered fish. B is farm, cultivate, incubate, or induce to spawn any genetically engineered fish. Why doesn't that say Atlantic salmon? I only find one reference to Atlantic salmon in the dash ones. That's on page 3.
Chair Gilliam, Representative Thompson, I appreciate you bringing that up. It's important to distinguish this bill really does two things. One is to address potential risk associated with genetically engineered fish. totally independent of the second thing that the bill does, which is provide a precautionary approach to a potential new pathogen which could arrive through Atlantic salmon. They're two totally distinct pieces of this.
I agree with you on that.
And so the genetic engineered piece of this is primarily related to the risks associated with those fish that have these recombinant DNA.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knowles. Thank you. With that, colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4060. Thank you, Mr. Bowles, for your testimony. And I'm going to reopen the public hearing and work session on House Bill 4050. And we're going to pick up where we left off. Vice Chair Krieger kicked us off, and I'm looking for my list because I'm getting tight. And I'd like Nancy Fitzpatrick, Joe Rolliter, and Jim Myron to come forward.
Yes, sir.
Three more, and then we will. We are at 9 minutes. If you can do this in 2 minutes each, I'd really appreciate it.
Go ahead. Yeah. You should have told all those people the last hour and a half to do that.
Representative, I'm trying to get your bill through.
Co-chairs and members, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society, and we support this bill.
Wow. You, that's just huge. You're back up on the list.
Is he an extra bill for that?
Thank you for that endorsement. Joe.
Let me go first. Okay.
Well, if that's what you want, that's what we want.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee members. I'm Nancy Fitzpatrick, Executive Director for the Oregon Salmon Commission. And the testimony you have in front of you is basically what I was going to talk about. The salmon industry has talked about this for many years and how we can help our industry grow. And one of the ways that we have discussed this is to eliminate the ODF&W lottery that requires permits to be sold if we go below our cap of 1,000 permits right now. And Rep. Krieger talked about some of those issues. And so the industry, like I say, we have had many meetings about this, and the industry supports this. Another piece of the bill that is included would eliminate a current requirement for a transfer of a permit. If a fisherman wants to transfer their permit to someone else wishes to buy it, currently they have to have in the previous year landed 100 pounds of salmon. If you remember, since 2006, the salmon industry, commercial salmon industry, has been in disastrous times, and some fishermen have not been able to land those 100 pounds. Therefore, they cannot transfer their permit unless they go before the Troll Permit Board and get an exemption. So this bill would eliminate that 100-pound requirement, which would help the industry be able to pass those permits along to others who wish to continue fishing. And that is part of our mission, is to keep the industry viable, keep fishermen involved who wish to participate. Questions?
Any questions for this panel?
I say something?
I said questions. Yes, please do.
Well, we just heard a bill that talked about the salmon industry. I just want to call your attention to the fact that here is another bill that addresses our salmon industry and the permits and is designed to keep it viable. So, food for thought.
That was certainly skillful.
No pun intended.
Representative Witt.
I can't help myself, Mr. Chairman, but you know how fish are brain food?
Right.
Representative Boone said food for thought. I'm sorry.
That's right.
And okay, then I can't let this go while we're at it. Remember our
any other comments?
Our little bycatch bill, this all feeds into it. Thank you.
Oh, wee-vee. All right. Thank you. Here, just get them all out, everybody.
Chair, have you been teaching lessons on the side?
No, I would never use that kind of strange language. Colleagues, I'm sorry for the disjointment in that, but I think we're ready to move ahead. So I'm going to close the... Oh, you do want to speak. You passed the ball. Okay, go.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, representatives. My name is Joe Rolliter. I represent Seafood Oregon, which is a coalition of the four commercial fishing commodity commissions, which includes the Salmon Commission. Over the years, I've worked on the drafting of legislation associated with numerous limited entry permit systems that are in our statutes in Oregon now. All limited entry systems go through maturing phases, and one of those phases is that the number of permits get reduced by attrition. So if people don't renew their permit, then the permit goes away. And that doesn't happen under the current regulations, and the salmon industry needs that. So we at Seafood Oregon support this bill. Thank you.
Good summary. With that, Representative Krieger.
If any of you attempt to contact the Commodity Commissions or Mr. Rowletter, he doesn't answer his cell phone, simply leave a message to put his fishing pole down and answer his cell phone, and he will return the call.
Wise advice, and we'll take it into consideration. Sorry, Joe, you threw you under the bus, but with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4050, and I will open a work session on House Bill 4050. I'll entertain a motion, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4050 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Bailey moves House Bill 4050 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I will ask our able clerk to call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Wick?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Bailey?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gillen?
Aye. The motion passes. And colleagues, since we are eliminating a lottery, I think Representative Tomei should carry this bill. No, it's a joke.
That's a joke.
How about you, Representative Krieger? Would you agree?
That'd be fine.
Wonderful.
That was bad.
The carrier is designated, and I believe we concluded our business, except to say, colleagues, we passed three bills on Tuesday, and I think you all know, and for those out listening, that was a complete scam because Representative Bailey's fiance was in the room. We were just doing that to impress her. Well, we may have to re-vote on those at a future time. Oh, it's okay. That's it. Any other comments?
Actually,
we're adjourned.
Actually, I think it